This is a mirror of public opinion. This is the National Hour. The National Broadcasting Company presents the first of a new weekly series, The National Hour. Yes, this is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what the world is thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems that we face along the road to peace and reconversion. Today, November 18th, 1945, we present the first of a new NBC series on major national problems, The National Hour. Our subject today,
food. F-O-O-D, food.
Now, this is Robert St. John in New York. It's about food that we're concerned in this initial presentation of the National Hour. But first, I'd like to tell you a little about what we plan to do in this series. This is an entirely new method of reporting on national issues because we're interested in fact, authentic documentation, a clear and abstract view of important national problems like food, wages, the housing situation, Army-Navy unification, and the like. There are many obstacles along the path to peace and reconstruction, problems that affect every one of us, problems that raise many questions. We intend to probe into all these questions with the aid of our staff of NBC reporters on the scene in foreign countries, our Washington newsroom, and our stations along the network, and with the help of experts and people in authority. You can be sure that our information is to the point, complete, and quite unbiased. We're interested in getting at the truth, with positive statements, forthright answers, and complete coverage of every major national issue. That's why today we've chosen food, the feeding of ourselves and of a war-torn, weary world. Hunger stalks the world today, and where there is hunger, there is unrest, disease, and death.
But what can we do?
We got enough to feed ourselves?
Have we enough to feed the world?
Has the world enough to feed the world?
Yes, we've picked a touchy subject, food, because the solution of this problem isn't simple. But NBC has documented the search for a solution for this edition of the National Hour. We'll hear from NBC's Robert McCormick in Washington and from our reporters overseas. Later, we'll hear from the Secretary of Agriculture, Clinton P. Anderson, and the Canadian, Andrew J. Cairns, chief of the food section of UNRWA.
Wait! You mean that phony relief outfit?
UNRWA's no good, never was.
What does UNRWA stand for, huh?
United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation.
Well, that ain't what it means.
Nah, UNRWA means Uncle Sam plays Santa Claus again.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's typical. Some people like UNRWA, some don't. We're not saying who's right or wrong, but there seems to be a division. Is UNRWA good? Or is it bad?
But we must send these people food.
I say let them starve.
Yes, there seems to be a difference of opinion.
Please, some food. Please, I'm so hungry.
You have to excuse my daughter. Very sick, hungry. And they tell me about democracy. What has democracy done for me?
Recognize these people? The father? The little girl, perhaps? No, probably not. They're strangers to most of us here in America. They're known as refugees, slave laborers, displaced citizens of ruined countries scattered everywhere, in Europe mostly, and in Asia. How many of them loose upon the world? More than 40 million. Yes, and I'd like to add that...
Yes, Bob McCormick?
Well, I'd like to add that according to estimates by official Washington, the borderline starvation cases amount to at least 200 million.
Hunger strides boldly across war-devastated lands. You can almost hear the steps, leading only to disease and death. Hunger always starks the ordinary common people, the non-combatants. For them, starvation begins about the time last shots are fired in Europe, Asia, the Pacific. Remember the end of the war?
Remember it? Boy, I'll say, what a night. Horns blowing, people dancing in the street, drinks on the house. What a time I had. What a night. What a night.
How about you, young man?
Sure, I remember. I was in the army then, artillery south of Leipzig. About chow time, when we got the word, we didn't laugh much or sing. We were thinking about going home. No more sea rations that night. Regular banquet, beans and bacon. But when I sat down to eat, the darndest thing happened.
What do you mean?
Scraping away at my grub, I looked up quick. There were seven of them refugees, displaced people, just standing and waiting till I tossed away a piece of my grub I didn't want. Garbage, anything. I figured right then that maybe the war wasn't really over. Just feeding and taking care of people like that was going to be a big job. Maybe our biggest job.
Feeding all the lost civilians was a big job. The people themselves couldn't do it. Even America couldn't do it alone. What was needed was the help of every one of our allies, every United Nation. And so UNRWA was born, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. As the Allied armies swept through Europe and Asia, as each nation was liberated, men of UNRWA went to work. They brought seeds and farm equipment, medical supplies and soap, and most precious of all, they brought food to starving civilians behind the battle line.
You mean they moved in right away?
That's different than I heard, Mr. St. John.
Year ago, I heard UNRWA wasn't feeding people at all.
What about all that bungling inefficiency?
Well, now, gentlemen, I promised earlier that we'd hear both sides of our question. You have some doubts, and we are looking for answers. Let's call on Bob McCormick in Washington.
Well, here is a Canadian member of UNRWA, Mr. Andrew Cairns. He's chief of UNRWA's food section and just returned from UNRWA headquarters in London. I believe he also heard those questions.
I certainly did, gentlemen. I have heard many questions and complaints, too. We admit to getting off to a slow start. We had food ready to ship into the liberated countries, but with the war still going on, we just couldn't get the ships to carry it across the Atlantic, and we didn't have enough personnel. But today we have men, and we are getting the shipping space we need.
Well, you're shipping food to where, Mr. Cairns?
To Albania, Czechoslovakia, Greece, Italy, Poland, White Russia, the Ukraine, and Yugoslavia. And on the other side of the globe as well, China and the Philippines. Those are nations which were overrun by the enemy and left in a terrible, stricken condition.
But there were others.
Certainly. But UNRWA ships food only to those countries which are incapable of paying for their food imports and foreign exchange. Now, France can pay, so can Belgium, Holland and Norway. So, they pay.
Well, during the past week, UNRWA Director Lehman and other witnesses have gone before Congress asking for more money to operate UNRWA.
Yes, Mr. McCormick. They've gone in a steady procession. And the reason is a simple one. UNRWA is broke. We've spent all our money.
Just a minute now, Mr. Cairns. I'm a taxpayer. I'd like to ask a couple of questions about this UNRWA outfit.
All right.
You men running UNRWA say you're broke. It seems to me Congress gave you about $800 million not long ago. We Americans the only ones coughing up the money?
No, sir. Each member of the United Nations contributes to a central fund. Uninvaded nations pay 1% of their national income, based on 1943 figures.
But we hand over better than $1 billion a year. And they say Brazil only pays $30 million or so.
The United States has a greater national wealth. That is why you contribute more money than, say, my own Canadian government. Each nation does pay proportionate to its income.
Well, I don't know. I'm not again feeding hungry people, but always seems like Uncle Sam gets left holding the bag.
Mr. Cairns, I suppose you've heard complaints like that many times.
Yes, indeed. And not only in the United States, Mr. St. John. We have critics in other nations, too. Nations that never had to suffer through an invasion. We get all kinds of complaints.
You know, I've got a question. A complaint.
All right.
Well, what I want to know, who takes charge of things when food lands in those foreign countries?
The government of each country handles the distribution, but only within that country. An owner has a representative on hand to make certain the food is distributed equally and without discrimination.
Well, I heard that UNRWA sent some food to those countries next to Russia, and the Russians took over the ships, said they sent the food and took all the credit, all of it. Could anything like that happen?
It could, of course, but it has not happened. We have heard such charges before. We have investigated them and found them to be false. The United States gets a great deal of credit for its help. In Poland, for example, UNRWA is called Amerykanski. The same sentiments are expressed in nearly every other country receiving our aid.
Well, I don't know about that, Mr. Kearns, but I do know that there's a lot of money going out, and we ought to watch it close.
Well, this week, Congress began trying to do just exactly that. A House committee considered the matter of a second UNRWA appropriation of $550 million... and the committee has already approved a so-called watchdog clause, providing that any country receiving aid from UNRWA must grant the American press free access to that country.
That's so the press can tell the story of where the food goes.
Yes, and President Truman this week asked Congress to appropriate our second year fund of $1.35 billion.
UNRWA is waiting for Congress to act, and for several other nations to appropriate their funds, you see. I'd like to say that my own impression of the contributions the uninvaded nations have made thus far, compared to those made by newly liberated countries, is this: too little, too late.
Don't go away, Mr. Cairns. We may have some more questions. But now, here's an important point. In all our research, we've never found a single statement denying the existence of hunger in lands stricken by war. But over here, and in many another country, there is debate over how much aid should be given and over how we give that aid. That's the way we do things. Everyone saying his piece. And we depend upon our authorities abroad and upon our trained newsmen over there to paint a true picture for us and to help guide us in our thinking. Our own staff of NBC reporters overseas, and I was one of them one time, and so was Bob McCormick, they covered the war. Now they cover the days of Reconstruction. Of course, when they speak of hunger, they don't mean every person living in a war-torn area. They don't mean every nation. There are degrees of hunger. So let's document this report on food by means of shortwave radio, by on-the-spot reports from NBC in other lands.
In England, one of the big prices the average housewife pays for food is time. Long queues, almost a day's work in themselves, and often empty shelves once the counter is reached. A family of three can still obtain the wartime ration of one and only one small roast a week. This can be supplemented by an individual weekly ration of about three slices of bacon and an occasional egg, by ample supplies of fish, ample supplies of vegetables, but little variety, by one pint of milk a person every 3 days, by ounces of butter, margarine, cheese, and cooking fats, and by infrequent shipments of tropical fruits. A member of Parliament said the other day that Britain was built by fat men. Although England isn't starving by any matter of means, not many men are getting fat today. The British diet is and will be, for some time to come, inadequate and monotonous. Far from living in a bed of roses, over here it's still a bed of Brussels sprouts and cabbages.
In France, food is still far from plentiful, but like Ed Harker in London, I can only report slight betterment in the situation here. Rations alone are not enough for growing children. Everyone cannot afford to resort to the black market. But as compared to the food situation last year, which was awful, things are slowly picking up. There is some meat, almost a half a pound with bone each week per person. There were no fats a year ago. Now you can reasonably count on nearly a pound a person each month. And there is some bread. Plenty of it, almost. But for some reason, there's still little milk. Only very small children can have any. Fresh fruit are out, and vegetables are scarce. Potatoes are a rarity because the crop was bad. Poultry is scarce, too, because of a plague due to the drought that killed a lot of fowl, and there are no eggs. Yet there is some food in rural districts, and it is obvious that some of the trouble may lie in distribution and transportation. Solving these problems would also kill the black market, which is partly responsible for the slow recovery of the French food situation.
Yes, there are degrees of hunger, as Ed Hawker and Paul Archinaud have just told you. And we've had other reports in recent weeks. From Athens, Greece...
There is famine in some sections of Greece. Winter weather finds thousands without fuel.
Bucharest?
Most of Romania's crops were destroyed under the feet of armies. There is little left for the winter.
In Vienna, Austria?
Emaciated figures cluster within the shells of bombed-out buildings, with every window shattered to let the winter winds blow through.
While the Axis nations spread their conquest, they had one simple formula. Strip the invaded nations, live upon the land. That's one of the causes of this whole vast food problem. In Germany and in Japan, people lived well for a time on curtailed rations, but the destruction heaped upon the Axis nations as our armies advanced naturally cut into the stores of food. Now, let's document this picture of the vanquished nations through another direct report.
In Japan today, the common denominator in all problems is food, or rather the lack of food. The Japanese cabinet is facing another crisis because the latest prime minister has done nothing about the food problem. This food shortage in Japan will soon reach into the American taxpayers' pocketbooks because before the Japanese can pay us a penny of the cost of occupying Japan, they must first feed their own hungry millions. Therefore, the staggering cost of our occupation of Japan must be paid by you and you and you and me. Another thing, before Japan can pay a single cent on reparations, she must get her undernourished millions back to an efficient working basis. But there are those here in Japan who claim that there is food to be had, and that the shortage is more a matter of inefficient distribution. You can bet that this angle is being investigated by the Supreme Commander before he okays any other relief measures, especially the wholesale importation of American food for Japanese consumption.
From George Thomas Folster in Japan to Roy Porter in Nuremberg, Germany, whose assignment covers four main points. First, the effect upon the children in Germany.
Well, Bob, they're not doing so well. The infant mortality rate is jumping sky high. They need milk and cod liver oil.
Howard...
And they eat too much bread, if I may add that.
Well, how are Germany's cities being supplied with food?
Well, Bob, the occupying nations have turned over thousands of trucks to bring food in from the countryside. But the great problem is transport. The Germans use theirs up for the army, and we don't have too much of it ourselves.
Well, are the rural areas any better off?
Yes, they are, Bob, simply because the farmers are growing their own food. But they are also hoarding it against a hard winter, and some of them won't let go of very much of their produce.
And what about this winter?
It's bad now. It's going to get worse. The Germans are getting more resentful and less aware that they have been defeated. They're attacking our soldiers and stealing our vehicles. There have been recent serious incidents, and they are continuing.
So that will be winter time in conquered Nazi land.
Now, wait a minute, Bob. I don't want to give the idea that people should let their sympathy run away with them. It's a tough question over here. The Nazis are still around. They're using this food question as the basis of anti-American activities. Now, it's true that mass fighting is stopped. But we haven't won the peace, not by a long way yet. We've got to keep many of our troops, and we've got to send home for some more. General Eisenhower knows more about it than any other one man. And he's perfectly right when he says the war is not over yet. So long, Bob.
Well, there are the facts, direct from NBC's on-the-spot reporters. Now let's see how they check with what Mr. Cairns has found.
Watching him as he listened, I'd say they check.
Right, Mr. McCormick. Disease and pestilence are walking hand in hand with hunger, as they always do. But when disease hits a people, they aren't interested in what type of government they have. And when hungry, they cannot eat democracy. They must have food and medicine. That takes time, and it takes money.
But if Congress appropriates the $550 million, will UNRWA's financial problems be solved?
Not by any means, Mr. McCormick. About half of that money, if we get it, will go to pay commitments already made.
But it will help.
Certainly. For example, we want to buy quantities of surplus fish from Norway and surplus beef overlooked by the Nazis. We were all set to buy it, but we were out of money. We have just made arrangements with the United States Army to purchase all their surplus C and K rations, and the 10-in-1 rations, too. We'll give out this food in Europe and China. Much of this supply of rations is stockpiled, right near our distribution centers overseas, and here in the United States, too. That means we won't need so many ships to haul it over. It's right on hand where it's needed.
Well, I hope those people like K rations better than I do.
Many of them will live because of those K rations. That's our first job, to avert starvation facing people now. Next to rehabilitation, to furnish seeds for new crops and equipment for their harvest.
But how much longer is this going on?
We're going to keep shelling out the dough?
Now, ain't it never going to end?
UNRWA is set up to face a temporary emergency in the wake of war. First, to avert starvation. Second, to aid in rehabilitation. And here's an interesting and an important fact. Every ton of seed and fertilizer and equipment which we send to these people will help to produce from 10 to 20 tons of food over there during the next harvest. That's the guarantee of better conditions and less starvation when the battlefields of the world become the grain fields.
And that documents the case for UNRWA. We've asked Andrew Cairns of the food section of UNRWA about the need for food in Europe and Asia, and we heard him state his official position. So that we...
Just a minute there, Mr. St. John.
Yes?
Now, there's no doubt in my mind about the need for food in all those countries, but I'm a storekeeper, and there's something I'd like to know. Now, if great quantities of food are taken from America's larder, will there be enough left for us folks back home?
Well, that's a question everybody's asking in New York and here in Washington and in Centerville. I won't give you the answer because we go to the experts to get the answers. And the expert for that question is the Secretary of Agriculture, Clinton P. Anderson.
Now, Mr. Secretary, I'd like to restate our question. If we ship great quantities of food overseas, will there be enough left for the people here at home?
The United States is one of the relatively few nations that has plenty of food for itself and some to spare for its allies. Because of the marvelous wartime production efforts of our farmers and the blessings of exceptionally good harvests, we have produced this year a third more food than we did in the average pre-war year.
Well, now that does not mean that we in the United States have so much food of all kinds that everyone can get all he wants of everything.
Not at all. That food supply has to be handled carefully, because it has many important jobs to do. First, we have our own people to feed. Then we have to feed our large military forces. We are helping to feed liberated countries.
And we still have the problem of seeing that certain not-so-plentiful items are fairly distributed.
That's right. For example, the United States food supply in 1945 has been divided about like this. Our civilians are getting 106 million tons, or nearly 80%. The armed services are receiving 13 million tons, or about 9%. We are exporting 16 million tons, or a little over 11%.
Well, what is the United States' own grocery list going to be like in the months ahead?
Frankly, it's going to be pretty good. We have plenty of potatoes, poultry, eggs, citrus fruits, and vegetables, all you want. We have more milk than ever before. However, people in this country have become such hearty milk drinkers during the war that demand for fluid milk in some areas is ahead of supply during the present season of low production.
Well, how about meats and fish and sugar?
We'll have larger supplies of meats and fish. We are short of sugar. And a tight supply situation in this commodity is likely to continue for some time. The butter supply is better than it has been, but we still don't have as much as we would like. And here's some good news.
What's that?
There seems to be no reason for your Thanksgiving dinner table to lack turkey. We have a record turkey crop, 22% above last year, and the Army and Navy are taking fewer of them than expected. In fact, there should be enough turkey to give every man, woman, and child in the nation about 5 pounds each, not counting the stuffing and gravy.
Will you give us a pretty happy picture, Mr. Anderson?
I believe that meat, as well as any food, provides a fair example of the way in which our efforts to help feed a hungry world can bring benefits to everybody concerned. Next year, the United States will have large supplies of meat, 21 pounds more for each and every one of us than we consumed in pre-war years. So we aren't going to suffer for lack of meat. Our farm markets will be maintained, and our loyal allies will be fed. I want to drive home 4 main points regarding the food situation.
We'll go right ahead.
First, the United States has sufficient food to feed its people adequately, and we still can help take the edge off starvation in liberated countries. Second, the United States is making the largest single contribution toward supplementing the food supplies of members of the United Nations, but we are not doing the whole job. Those nations themselves are producing the major part of their food.
Third point?
By far the largest part of the food we are now sending abroad is going to nations who are paying for it. Through UNRWA, we are helping to foot the bill for only 1/3 of the supplies going for relief feeding.
And the fourth point?
The United States and its allies made the greatest sacrifice of lives in all history to keep their freedom and to win the opportunity for a lasting peace. American food, by helping to rout hunger and unrest, can be one of the most powerful forces in the world for clinching that great victory into a lasting peace. That is why we pledged ourselves to help our allies to the limit of our strength. We are keeping that pledge.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And now for a statement of today's facts and figures, here is Robert St. John.
Food has been the subject of our documentary, and this is what we have learned.
First, the facts.
Hunger stalks throughout the world, breeding death, disease, revolution. There is one working international organization ready and equipped to relieve suffering by relief and rehabilitation, UNRWA. And lastly, the Secretary of Agriculture has assured us that for all reasonable home requirements, our domestic food supply is more than ample.
And now, the finding.
Food is the greatest weapon of peace. The hungry cry to be fed. UNRWA has said it's now prepared to do the job originally intended because today it has the personnel and the ships to carry the food. But it has no money. That appeal for funds is now up for consideration before the Congress of these United States.
On the subject of food, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to return next week when the National Hour will consider a problem uppermost in the minds of those seeking homes, the housing situation.
The National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington and from London, Paris, Nuremberg, and Tokyo, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the first of a new series, The National Hour. Speakers on today's broadcast were Clinton P. Anderson, Secretary of Agriculture, and Andrew Cairns of UNRWA. Your moderator was Robert St. John, and your narrators, Robert McCormick and Ed Herlihy. Program direction, Jack Hill and Maurice Robinson. Script by Tom Goutte. Music composed by Leo Kempinski, conducted by Milton Katims. The entire production was supervised by Ed Schneider. And this is the National Broadcasting Company.